where I've been and who I am, all the ways I've grown.
This isn't self-help, it's a full-on rebirth. Welcome to Girl Wake Up, the podcast for women who are done playing small, staying silent, or living by rules they never wrote. I'm Amy Polacco, journalist, divorce and life coach, and freedom warrior, and I'm here to help you take your power back. Because the system isn't going to save us. We need to save ourselves. So grab your coffee, your courage, and maybe a few curse words. It's time to wake up. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Girl Wake Up. I admire our guest today so much. She is a warrior, not just for herself, for her sister, for all women. Today, we're talking to author and activist Michelle Horton about coercive control, systems that fail women, and what happens when survival is reframed as criminality. Lord knows we see this in the family court system all the time on a daily basis, but thank you so much for being here, Michelle.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
And, you know, we've gotten to know each other over the past year or two, right? I saw you speak. You know, I want everyone to know about your book. It's right here. Well, it's behind you, too, for everybody who's watching on YouTube. But for those listening, Michelle is the author of Dear Sister, a memoir of secret survival and unbreakable bonds. She's an acclaimed, you know, memoirist that explores the full impact that domestic violence and criminalized survival has on a family and a community. The author's sister, Nicole Adamondo, spent 7 years incarcerated for killing her abuser and was released from the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in January of 2024. That's right near where I live. I'm in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Like, my church does things for the female, I hate to say the word, inmates right there at the Bedford Hills, right? And many of them wrongfully incarcerated. Michelle is also the co-founder of the Nicole Adamondo Community Defense Committee, an advocacy group that brings awareness and action toward the decriminalization of domestic violence survivors. And, you know, you've just had some major wins. I've been following you and everything you are doing. But first, before we get into that, Michelle, you know, when we talk about wake up calls here on Girl Wake Up, I can't think of a bigger one than what you had to go through. Can you tell everybody who doesn't know what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was September of 2017. And I was a newly single mom. I was just living an ordinary life. And I got a knock on the door. I think it was a Thursday morning, getting my kid out to school. And it was a police officer who said, "Your sister is at the police station," which is just a very jarring thing to hear alone, just because she was my little sister. At the time, she was 28. She had no criminal history. She had, you know, she was an early educator, early childhood educator. She was a single, she was a stay-at-home mom. Like, her life revolved around her kids. So to say she was at the police station, I had no context for that. They said, "You have to pick up your niece and nephew." They were 2 and 4 at the time. And I had no information from there, just the feeling that we perhaps were in a family emergency. So I did end up going to work. And throughout the day, information started trickling in. And by the end of the day, I had an entirely new reality. Like, it was a wake-up call of the largest variety.
And you do such a great job in the book of taking the reader with you, right? There's like that suspense of like, what is happening?
Right. Like, people start coming into my life who had been in Nikki's life for a year plus trying to help her. And they told me, first of all, I learned my sister shot and killed this man who was the father of her kids, who I thought I knew pretty well. I knew as well as you think you can know anyone. They were together for almost a decade, and they shared the 2 kids. And I didn't know they had a gun in the house. I didn't know she knew how to shoot a gun. That was crazy to me. And that she had been trying to leave this relationship, that over the years, with each subsequent birth of their kids, escalated in severity to the point where a police officer was tracking evidence. A lot of the stuff he was doing to my sister, he was actually uploading to the internet with horrific captions, which a police officer was tracking. There were, the DA's office had a file that showed that this woman was in a severely, like, the lethality assessments she was given, she was at the highest, you know, lethality risk of herself being killed, and that there were kids in the house and, you know, something needed to be done, and nothing was done for years until the injuries started escalating, whereas she was starting to get visible bruises where prior to that, everything was not seen. Somebody in the community, someone who actually worked with him, saw her bruised, saw a side of him that scared her, and she was a mandated reporter. So she thought she was doing the right thing by calling CPS and saying, I think this woman is being abused and I think it's affecting her kids, because their oldest son, who was four, was experiencing, you know, what to us on the outside looked like normal separation anxiety. But to someone who was looking at it through a different perspective, they saw an anxiety that was perhaps linked to abuse. So CPS did what they are trained to do. They come in and they say, are you hurting her? Is he hurting you? No. They leave. And less than 24 hours later, a gun is in my sister's face. A murder-suicide is very clearly the plan, given his search history and all of the things I write about in the book. And she is lucky to have the instinct. You know, she likes to say she did not decide to shoot him. It was a survival instinct that she got the gun, and she knew if she didn't pull the trigger, herself and her kids would likely be killed. So on a survival instinct alone, she pulled the trigger. She went to the police, said, this is what happened. And they immediately did not believe her. So as I am on the outside, my sister is immediately ushered into jail. I have her kids. I get emergency custody of them. And I'm trying to understand what is happening. The legal situation is really scary and very real. She has potential murder charges. Yet there's these women, a trauma therapist, a former social worker, these people who had been helping my sister try to escape. They're saying, look at all this evidence. Like, there's no way that they're going to prosecute.
Right. I think that is the most remarkable thing, Michelle. I mean, there's so much in your book, which is incredible, and I want everyone to buy it and read it, is that it's not like this was just hearsay. There was so much evidence. And, you know, it harkened back for me, you know that I co-authored this book, Framed, Women in the Family Court Underworld, that is, you know, stories of women from around the world. And there's so much evidence in a lot of these also. And it's like, it just boggles your mind. And until you're thrust into a situation like this, you kind of think, well, our legal system is just and fair, right? I mean, isn't there that cognitive dissonance going on? Tell us what was going on for you.
Well, so there were several wake-up calls. The first one being that someone that I was very close to could be in such a horrifically violent relationship behind closed doors, and I didn't recognize the signs. So that was the first, like, what the people, you really don't know what's going on inside of people and what people are capable of.
You never know what's happening behind closed doors, right? You know, I'm in Fairfield County, Connecticut. Sometimes people think, oh, you know, someone lives in a multi-million-dollar house. Does not matter. This does not discriminate, right, Michelle?
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second one was that I do think I had a basic trust in our system. I think I was kind of, I don't want to use the word brainwashed, but I am going to use the word brainwashed, to think that, like, prosecutors are good guys. Juries are fair and impartial. Judges make the right choice, and the truth comes out in courtrooms. And I very quickly learned that is not the case at all. So it was everything that I thought I knew from the system down to, like, myself was turned on its head. And I felt like every day was like, okay, just give me the information, to just tell me the truth, and we'll get through this, like, literally minute by minute, because I didn't have any foundation of reality anymore.
Right. And it's so disheartening that the prosecutor in the case is a woman, right, and is particularly harsh. And I'm wondering, at what point did you look around and say, this isn't just an us problem, this is a systemic one? Because I remember my first experience in family court, I was like, this is like the Twilight Zone. This is crazy. And then I heard another story and became an advocate. And like you, you're devoting your life to helping other victims in these situations. Like, was there that moment that you were just overwhelmed at the sheer enormity of it?
Oh, definitely. And I think it became pretty clear quickly because we, as a group of women, were reaching out for every bit of help we could get. We needed experts to guide us. We needed to know who were the right people to hire, what legal team was the right. And then we realized there's like a real specialty in gender-based violence of people who can, you know, take these kinds of cases because they're complicated and they're not black and white. And nothing about domestic violence is black and white, yet the criminal legal system is set up to be black and white. So when something falls in that gray area, it doesn't really know what to do with it. So very quickly, we were not only aware that there were like case law and legal specialties around this, but that there were entire organizations that were devoted to helping what I came to know were criminalized survivors. And when I would tell these experts, this is what's happening, isn't this crazy? The reaction I was getting was like, yeah, this is what happens.
Yeah, right. This is how, part of the mill. Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, you get to the end of the homicidal lethality and it's the victim dies, the victim fights back and is then criminalized. Those are really kind of where you're at.
Right. And I'm wondering, Michelle, you know, why do you think self-defense is so hard to prove for women, especially in cases involving long-term abuse? And you know, I've written about coercive control, too. Sometimes you don't see the bruises and it, you know, ends in a violent situation. I mean, what do you think about the way women are portrayed in this realm?
Well, on a base level, I know that our self-defense laws are not written to work for women. And I will direct people who are listening to Rachel Louise Snyder, who has written op-eds in the New York Times about this, and Lee Goodmark, who is a very prolific writer on this subject. And they write with clarity about why our self-defense laws do not work. They are written for basically like two men of equal size in a brawl outside of a bar kind of thing. It does not take into the power dynamics that are at play with coercive control. It doesn't take into effect the long-term psychological and emotional you know, dynamics at play when you're dealing with domestic violence. Self-defense laws are like, there's an incident and you're looking at that incident and what happens right before the incident and what happens right after the incident. And that is what the court case looks at. Whereas self-defense, when it comes to domestic violence, you really need to zoom out. And we, in a lot of cases, don't have the legislation to support that. So the laws as they're written don't work.
Right. And in your sister's case, you know, it was argued, oh, he was just relaxing on the couch. Like he was this innocent victim, right? When he had just threatened her with a gun. Right. And so, you know, it's taking all of that whole lead up. You know, often I work with divorce coaching clients where I see it bubbling. I liken it to like a pot of water on the stove, right? Like when you start boiling a pot of water, it doesn't go the other direction. Like it's just getting worse and worse and worse, and it's escalating. You can tell. And I often have to say to them, I see this escalating, you know, because I am scared for their safety. You know, I'm wondering, how do you think coercive control is discussed in the courtroom? Is it erased in the courtroom? Are, you know, professionals in the legal world understanding it more? What do you think?
You know, what's interesting about what I experienced and what I witnessed is that I was learning about coercive control in the sense of intimate partner coercive control. But then I was navigating the legal system for my sister and also sitting in the courtroom and watching the prosecutor and watching the judge and realizing that the system itself operates through coercive control. It works to pressure and threaten and hold power over and really coerce people into doing what you want to do, saying what you want them to say for all sorts of reasons. And I had a very sinking feeling as I was watching the trial play out that a system that operates through coercive control is never going to hold coercive control abusers accountable because they're using the exact same tactics.
That is such an astute observation, Michelle, because we talk about that in our book Framed as well, because, you know, women all the time are told to just go with the flow, right? In divorce, for example, even when there's abuse, you know, just don't mention it. Don't bring it up. Just, you know, sign here, agree to this. This is what a judge will say. The judge doesn't want to hear about it. Because a lot of these judges, family court, they don't want to be there. They're not trained in domestic abuse or coercive control for that matter. So it's overwhelming to look around and think, who is going to stand up for me? I mean, thank God your sister had you and the whole group and movement you formed that was out there picketing and, you know, doing all of these things, because some women don't have that, right?
Yeah. And so, I mean, to answer your question earlier about training, I do think there is a severe lack of trauma-informed understanding amongst judges and prosecutors and jury members, quite frankly. I think education is really important. But with that education, it's going to require the people within the system to take a good hard look at how the system itself is structured. And if this, if we have an abusive system, I think we can all agree we need to take a closer look at that and redesign a system that is not predicated on power and control. It would need to be ripped down to its very foundation, because that's what it's built on.
Well, that's why a lot of people say we just need to blow up the justice system and start over, right? I mean,
I'm not, from everything that I've seen and learned, I feel like abolitionism is the logical conclusion. I don't find it to be radical. I think it's actually the most logical and healing direction we can go in. I just don't know how you reform something that is corrupt at its core.
Right. I agree with you. And let's talk a little bit about this myth of the perfect victim, right? Because we see this in Hollywood and, you know, different high profile celebrity trials like Amber Heard, you know, that, you know, the woman who's claiming abuse has to be absolutely perfect in every aspect. She has to report right away. She has to do this, right? Because there were people who said, well, how come Nikki didn't report it, right? How come she didn't tell someone? Look what's happening in the Epstein scandal now.
I know. If there's not a clearer example of the way that our system regards women and children, the Epstein files is right there. It, you know, for anyone who did not have
a way triggering, to call, right? Triggering for all of us.
Yeah. And it's also like, if you have any experience in the system, you understand, of course, this is not surprising. Like, of course, this is how it goes.
Right. But how did you feel when they were maligning your sister's character in some of these instances?
I mean, it is the tactic. I have not seen a single case across the country throughout decades that I've researched where there was not a character assassination, because it is so easy to do it to women in our misogynistic culture. It is just, it's there for the taking. It's embedded in all of us. You know, it is easy to convict and cage women because we have been doing it forever.
Right. It's those stereotypical tropes, right? She was manipulative. You know, it's like the woman who's raped, you know, she asked for it. She wore a short skirt. She walked home alone at night. You know, she did this, she did that. She came on to him. All of these things that demonize the woman over and over again.
And I really feel like my sister's case is such an example of someone who could have been a quote unquote perfect victim, as far as like, she's tiny, she's petite, she's white, she's a young mom, she's a preschool teacher, like she's beloved by people in her community. And yet for someone who has no record, she, you know, a lot of victims use drugs to cope with, or they're being coerced into drug use, or there's all of this stuff that makes them look less sympathetic. My sister on paper looked like she would be the quote unquote perfect victim. And even in her case, if there isn't something that you can highlight that makes them, you know, look bad to the jury, they will make it up and they will twist things out. I mean, they had his search history and my sister's search history, and they made arguments that were printed in the paper that she did the stuff on his phone. There was no evidence of that. They didn't even take fingerprints of his phone, but they were like, oh, well, look at these searches that are on his phone. Clearly she must have done that. It's just the mental gymnastics and the character assassination is at the heart of it. And I never like to speak for my sister, but I think I can say that that has been one of the most damaging things to her psyche, is to watch her narrative get taken from her inside of a courtroom and inside of, you know, the court of public opinion. Things that did not happen, they said happened. Things that did happen, they say didn't. It's so disorienting and it's so cruel to do to somebody.
How is she doing now? I mean, I think some of the most touching parts of the book is really how you care for her children so lovingly, you know, when she's away and she can't be with them and you are fighting this huge battle and taking care of them and taking care of your son, you know. But how is she doing now? I know you guys live together and...
We do. We have a house together. We raise our kids together. The kids say they have two moms, which sometimes is confusing for people at the school. You know, I could not think of a better co-parent than my sister. And I know that it was incredibly hard. And there is so much that she lost through their separation that will never get back. And it was hard to keep them connected. But I do think that we're seeing the fruits of that labor now, because, you know, they're reunited and everyone has very different experiences inside of the same house, right? Like for me, it's like, oh, we bought this house together and she's in a much better situation than most people who are just spit out of prison and they're in a halfway house and they don't know where their kids are and their parental rights were terminated. Like, thankfully, none of that happened with her. But you know, the healing, she could not even begin to start healing until she stepped out of the door of the prisons, because it's not safe to do that inside. And the layers of trauma are very, very slowly being healed. And we just did an event together at the University of Georgia, where we were talking to law students and she zoomed in. And, you know, she's very candid about how lonely it is to, you know, the CPTSD that she carries comes right. with so many side effects that are invisible and people don't understand. People might assume because she's out, things are like happy and wonderful.
Yes.
But she has so much to heal from, not only what happened in her home with someone she loved, but what happened in the courtroom and what happened in jail and prison. It's just layers and layers of abuse that, is a lonely experience for her, because inside of her body, sometimes she is still in her cell, you know, and mm-hmm. she feels like she should be, you know, healed by now, or she, you know, should be showing up in a certain way. So it's, you know, it will be a lifelong process for everyone, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And it's remarkable that she's able to speak about it. And obviously the work both of you are doing, speaking and sharing this story, is God's work. I mean, you're validating for, you know, survivors and the women who are still incarcerated wrongly, right?
I mean, because like we were saying with the character assassination, the thing that is taken from these women is their voice. It's not safe. It's not advisable legally, all sorts of reasons for them to stay quiet. So I felt like, and also like if my sister were sitting here right now, I'm sure she could have an entirely different conversation with you that would be insightful and incredible for people. But the toll that that takes on her to have to relive all of that, I feel like if at this point I can articulate things right. and I can bring awareness, that, you know, I'm really happy to bring awareness to everyone who is voiceless in this, including the kids, right? The kids right. who have to experience
yes, the children who suffer. Right. You know, I'm wondering for women out there who are stuck in these abusive relationships, trapped, and, you know, more and more these days with our economy and things being more expensive, I feel like I hear women who are scared to leave. How can I make it financially, right? They see what's going on in our world, in this, you know, Epstein horror, and wonder, can I really escape my abuser, or is it pointless? I'm wondering what you say to women like that as a beacon of hope, now.
Yeah. Well, as just before the hope, just to be validating, perhaps, I don't think it's a faulty logic to worry that the system is not going to believe you. But I do want to say that every corner of this country and everywhere that I have looked where there are these cases, there are organizations and there are these underground networks of mostly women, not all women, but who do this work and who will believe you, like whose internal constitution is to believe you and to help you, and that there are people out there who you can trust. It's a matter of finding them, rather than trusting and just assuming that it's only the institutions that you have to rely on, because time and again, they do let us down. But there are so many people out here who can help and can, you know, lead you to the next person, to the next person, to the next person. You know, talking about doing God's work, I feel like the people who work at these shelters are doing God's work.
Yes, absolutely.
And they're there to like be able to help you with your utility bills or to be able to help you with transportation. And it's just a matter of where you look, right? You know, looking to the DA's office might not be at this moment in your life the safest choice, but where can you look? And I think looking to the advocates and the organizations who do this work in every community, that's really the better first step, I think.
Absolutely. And you know, that's why my heart has led me to this work, because I rushed into the family court system without educating myself, without understanding how messed up it is. And you go and hire an attorney, you trust that they've got your back. And that's not always the case, right? And that's why I think every woman who's considering divorce should meet with a divorce coach, a strategist who understands the system, can help you get your ducks in a row, find the right attorney who's going to do right by you. You know, I only recommend very few, you know, who I know have represented women like my clients, and, you know, understand coercive control, understand domestic abuse, understand if a woman's been a stay-at-home mom for 25 years and, you know, has no income, you know, she must get some support, right? So I think there are so many advocates out there doing this work.
Yeah. And it's so important how you frame it, right? Like that is the most important strategy, to have people in your corner who understand it and can make those arguments, because the arguments are there to be made. It does make sense if you put it all into context, but too many lawyers are not looking at it through the correct context.
Right. And before we move on, Michelle, I just want to point out for everybody that Nikki was released because of a 2019 law, right, Michelle, the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act.
Yes.
And so if it was not for this law, she might still be,
she would be
in prison. So could you just explain a little bit about the dramatic turn in this case?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of dramatic turns in this case.
True.
So she was convicted in 2019, which was shocking and terrible and just awful. And then literally weeks later, this legislation was signed into law, ironically by Andrew Cuomo in New York. But it took 10 years of advocacy for this law to work. And honestly, 10 years plus, I actually just watched this documentary called Beyond Survival. It's incredible. You should watch it. And it starts with women in 1986 who are at Bedford Hills talking about the beginnings of this. And I was born in 1986. So this is my lifetime.
Yeah.
Right. So finally, after a lifetime of work, this law was finally passed, the first of its kind, which does not say women who are abused or victims of abuse should not be prosecuted if they're acting in self-defense. It just says if somebody is commits a crime and domestic violence is a significant contributing factor to that crime, the judges should be able to consider that and offer a lower sentencing structure. It's basically a sentencing reform law.
Right.
And so it was passed. And so we thought, you know, the minimum she could have at her conviction was 15 years to life. It's a life sentence. And at 15 years, she could perhaps be granted parole. I was doing a lot of research and saw that a lot of times parole boards do not give victims relief through parole if you're identifying as a victim because it's not, quote unquote, taking responsibility for what you did. So another way victims are trapped, right?
Right, right.
So it was really important to have that life off of her sentence. And the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act was quite literally the only way that was going to happen. And because there was so much advocacy around this bill, we were able as a committee to go to the legislators, to go to the advocates, to go to the organizations that have put their livelihood into this and say, this is the first test of this law. If it fails, what is this going to say to other? What is this going to say for the efficacy of the law in general? And how is it going to affect future survivors? So people had some skin in the game to finally start speaking up.
Right, right.
And to start, you know, getting some movement into our movement. And we were really hopeful. Nikki had to go through an entire new, basically mini trial where she had to prove more evidence of abuse, which she did. And this judge, his name was Judge McLaughlin, who sat through the whole trial, made a lot of evidentiary rulings that were suspect, a lot of things that we thought were very biased. He decided she did not qualify for the law. And he gave her a sentence of 19 years to life. He said in his sentencing, I understand, like, perhaps you reluctantly consented to intimate acts you were uncomfortable with, but you didn't have to kill him. That was his argument in a nutshell. And because the logic was faulty that because she committed the crime, she didn't get relief under the law. So it definitely sent shockwaves out in our corner of the mm-hmm. universe into the advocacy world. First, that the law didn't work, and also what he said on the record about it.
Right.
So we, you know, got even more organized and got an appellate attorney to help and all this pro bono work,
yes.
which was a godsend. And the appellate court in 2021 said she did qualify for the law and resentenced her to 7.5 years. And
she
I write
served.
In the book.
Yeah.
Well, she had 3 more years to serve.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Which was hard for us because, you know, we wanted the courts to say she shouldn't have served a minute
right.
and should like get some kind of restitution or something
right.
for this experience. But she had 3 more years, which was how the hardcover book ended, because that at the time was the reality yeah. of our lives was this, you know, finally the courts heard her and yet we still have to wait more time. Yeah. The paperback version includes her homecoming.
Which was in 2024, correct?
Which was in 2024, yeah. So
right.
the law saved her life. And since then, it has Oklahoma passed a law similar to New York's. Georgia did, which is why we were down
Incredible,
there talking.
Incredible, yeah.
Massachusetts, New Jersey has one. Connecticut's working on one. So yep. they're spreading, which is wonderful. But they're not working as well as they should.
And tell us about the judge, Michelle.
Yes, so... They're really great. So judges in New York are elected and they sit for 10 years. And so when this case happened in 2017 and she was assigned this judge, he, by the way, was a former prosecutor in the office, the DA's office, when all of this stuff was happening with my sister, when there was like, should we prosecute? Should we not prosecute? Like he was in the office that knew her as a victim. Mm-hmm. So I felt this is a conflict of interest, right?
Yes. Yes.
How can he be impartial? So I went to the attorneys at the time and they said, listen, he was just elected in 2015. You've got like 8 years left of this guy on the bench and there's nothing that you can do. Like he has to decide for himself if it's a conflict of interest.
Which is crazy. And we talk about like judicial immunity, right? And how they can.
Oh, it's the power that they have is absolute. Almost. And the only way, I mean, even with all of the backlash he got for what he said,
right,
there
right.
was still no way to get him off of the bench. He sat and he had more victims' lives in their hands. And he, I know for a fact, created more wreckage in our county. So then we were like 2025, like we're not forgetting. So our committee had been laying the groundwork for years about this guy and like waiting.
I love this part.
And we were just like, who is gonna go against him? Because he's very powerful. He's very resourced. He was well-liked yep. within the system. He was a system guy.
Of course.
And so the person who ended up going against him was Nikki's first public defender, who, if you read the book, you know, Nikki yes. was very connected to her. She was younger. She was smart. She was actually the first person to do her own research and really like understand Nikki. And after eight right. months on the case, the judge took her off, which we could talk about why, but it was an absolute nightmare that he, for very bogus reason, decided there was a conflict of interest on the public defender and removed her, which really set her entire case up for failure. So fast forward to 2025, she decides, I'm going to go against this guy. Everyone said, you can't do it. Like, there's no way a woman who is a public defender, she was a prosecutor too, but a public defender right. who's seen as soft on crime is going to unseat this incumbent who is very powerful. And I actually just got a picture. Let me see exactly what it said. So fast forward, I actually ended up joining her campaign officially to help yes. her, plus running the We Stand With Nikki. And like, we just did everything we could. And
right.
I've
been watching this on social media, cheering you on.
Yeah. It said that Kara, her name was Kara Gary. She had the highest number of votes for any candidate in the election cycle. So people wow. came out in droves. And I mean, I'm sure McLaughlin will say all of the reasons why it happened. And it wasn't just because of Nikki, but we know, all of us know.
Yes.
Nikki's case was the driving force behind
mobilizing. Because it got so much publicity and people yeah. read the stories and...
And there's so much helplessness. Like, what can you possibly do? It was like, now we can actually do something. And it doesn't require your money.
Yep.
Doesn't require you standing outside with signs. Doesn't, you know, putting your
life
in jeopardy.
It's voting.
You just have to go to a voting booth and vote. And people did it. And then just a couple of weeks ago, Nikki and I sat in that courthouse. It was our first time back since Nikki was taken
wow.
away. And we watched her put on the black robe and take her place for a 10-year term. And we know that Dutchess County is in a much better place now than when we found it.
Right. Because she understands this, right?
Yeah.
She is empathic and she has educated herself, which leads me, Michelle, to our truth or trap segment we have here on Girl Wake Up, where, you know, I share a common societal, you know, message or thought. And I'd love to hear your reaction. You could say whether it's truth or trap. And it ties into what we were just talking about. Juries understand domestic violence better today than they did 20 years ago. Do you think that's true?
I mean, I have no data to know what 20 years ago people
right.
Knew. I would like to think that there is a bit more mainstream understanding, but I haven't really seen evidence of that. And mostly because when it comes to domestic violence cases that juries are a part of, mm-hmm. One of the prerequisites to be on the jury is that you have no experience with domestic violence. So if you have anyone in your life who you knew or yourself went through domestic violence, or you have some kind of education or credentials, they were wiped from the jury for bias. Although it's supposed to be a jury of your peers who could walk in my sister's shoes. So how could they possibly, if they had no understanding of domestic violence? But the thought is you want them to be educated by experts on the stand first.
Right.
But what you aren't always told is that what juries get, whether it's from testimony on the stand in this very like ask and answer format, and also the evidence that's let in, is they're getting only a sliver of the information.
Right.
And
right.
it's very like, the domestic violence expert is going to speak on the defense side, and then a domestic violence expert is going to speak on the prosecutor side. So it's not like it's one expert.
Right,
who's just
right.
You're going to get conflicting information to the jury, and then you're relying on them to not have any domestic violence myths already in their head,
right.
which are so embedded that it just becomes like impossible to have a fair trial, in my opinion, when it comes around domestic violence.
Yes, I agree with you. And we have a listener letter from someone who I know their situation told them you were coming as a guest. And she says, "Dear Michelle and Girl Wake Up, I've been in an abusive marriage for 8 years. It's never left visible bruises, but it's left me afraid of what he may do next. I often think about calling the police, but I'm scared that they may not believe me. when I think about stories like your sister's, it terrifies me. If I defend myself, will anyone believe me? I'm unsure what to do. How is a woman supposed to survive when every option feels dangerous? I mean, I think one of the things is we talked about it is you've got to find people in this world who do believe you, right, and help you. But I'm sure you get these questions all the time, Michelle, when you're in speaking engagements, people emailing you, you know, messaging you. What? And I know you can't give advice without knowing more about someone's situation, but what do you tell women these days?
Yeah. I mean, and I also am trying to be very like upfront that I don't have the credentials to be giving like actual advice. But I mean, like we were talking about earlier, I think it's very important to be working with an advocate who understands the system and can help safety plan and can help document. Because even though things went really poorly for my sister who had all of that in place, if she didn't, it would have been worse.
Yeah.
So having someone who knows how to document things and can be your support system through this, I think is like the most important thing is to work with an advocate at an agency who you trust.
Absolutely. And I think that shows it's evidence that you raised your hand and said, there's a problem. Like, I know this is abuse. I know that it was an attorney I talked to who said to me, Amy, this is abuse and coercive control. You need to go to the women's center to like their support group. And I was like, you know, it was so validating for me. I had a client a year or so ago who was literally beaten physically and left the state to go to a friend's, went to an emergency room, had everything documented. And then when she came back and tried to get a restraining order, she was denied and was told, why'd you wait so long? I mean, she had so much evidence. And so I think, you know, unfortunately, you always have to be thinking, right, a devil's advocate. How are they going to spin this? How are they going to try to smear me? How are they going to, right?
Yeah. And I think you should expect that. I think you shouldn't be surprised. And I think it's being proactive to get ahead of that and having your system, like your support around you
exactly.
is so important to have. Yeah.
Right. That's why when I go back to that, you know, when it starts bubbling and you know it's escalating, you've got to get a plan. Because I often see in my divorce coaching that women are in this situation and I can tell that, you know, he's about to call the police and turn the tables on her and say, oh, she, I need a restraining order. She's dangerous. And sometimes women, we are, you know, kind a lot of times. We're empathic. We don't really understand how evil someone could possibly be until it happens. And so one of the hardest things I have to do is say, listen, I can tell the writing's on the wall here. Like he's trying to frame you, right?
Yeah.
And we've got to get ahead of this for you.
Yeah, it's so important. Well, I think we can't just like expect that one day we're going to find like the magical police officer who's going to believe us or that the system is going to work for us. I think we know enough that we need to like know we're in the odds are stacked against us and we need to stack them as much as we can in our favor.
Right. And, you know, thanks to you and your sister, this is a safer world for us. And let's hope in every state you are having a difference and making a difference. Everybody, please read this book. I read it and I listened to it on Audible as well when I was on a trip, which was great. Where can people find this, Michelle, and you?
Yeah, it's available anywhere you get books. I always like to direct people to independent bookstores.
Yes.
If you can. Libro FM is a great place to listen to the audiobook. The audiobook is very special to me because you can have, you can hear recordings in it. Like you can hear
phone calls
from jail. You can hear the kids' voices. You can hear my sister. It's hard, but I think emotionally, there's an emotional resonance to it that I really like. And as for where to find me, MichelleHortonWriter.com for like writing related things. And then WeStandWithNikki.com for advocacy related things.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy speaking schedule to be here on Girl Wake Up.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Girl Wake Up. I'm your host, Amy Polacco. If this episode woke something up in you, don't let it fade. Share it with a friend who needs to hear it, leave a review, and keep this conversation going. Remember, no one's coming to save you. So she did.